From Albania to Uzbekistan, emerging economies from Central Europe to Central Asia have experienced shifts in population. But are we focusing enough on how movements of people within a country are affecting its development? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, last week, we spoke to Sergei Guriev, chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, about the bank's transition report. This year, the report's focusing on the changing nature of work. And this week, we're back again at the EBRD headquarters to focus on where that work is done. Today, I'm talking to Nate Young. Welcome, Nate.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
About one of the most fascinating parts of this report, and that's the focus on the geographic transition in countries in the region. So the first thing to ask you, Nate, is what do you mean by the geographic transition?
By geographic transition, we mean changes in the types of locations where people live, such as relocating from the countryside into cities, and also the actual places where people are living, meaning between actual cities, countries, or regions. I think it's important to examine the reorganization that's underway in Europe and the EBRD regions that is happening from smaller villages into cities and into cities that are increasingly large urban environments. And sometimes these moves are happening at long distances where people are not ending up close to where they started out. So this chapter aims at providing a systematic examination of these changes, which we're going to interpret through the lens of economic theory from fairly micro beginnings.
It's quite a big shift, isn't it? But we don't hear very much about it.
Indeed. We find that the regions experienced a really high degree of urbanization in the last 10 years, last 25 years. We motivate this chapter by looking at a three-dimensional map of Western Europe and portions of the EBRD regions. This map shows changes to population at really fine levels, about 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers. And some things stand out really strikingly. One is the concentration of population growth in Europe's geographic center. This is northern Italy, portions of France and Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, up through London. We also see concentrations into major cities. These stand out. And we see decreases in population from Europe's periphery, from the Baltic states, from Central and Southeastern Europe, the Western Balkans. The other thing that stands out is quite interesting is the increases in population along coastlines in what EBRD calls the southern and eastern Mediterranean area, Egypt's Nile and the Delta, as well as portions of Turkey.
Where do you get the data for this? Because that must be quite hard to collect.
There are some really great data sets out there now to be working with. These data are really highly granular, meaning that the information is broken out into fine geographic units with the ability to arrange these on a map. So we use geographic information systems, GIS. We use GIS software to look at these data. One of these data sets comes from the European Commission, which builds on a data set maintained by Columbia University. This is the GHS population grid and pulls data together from 1975, 1990, 2000, 2015 to project data out into really small units, about 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer grids of population. Another one we look at is the GEcon data, which is looking at 1 degree by 1 degree. It's about a 111 kilometer square at the equator. We look at the GEcon data because we can see both population and real GDP broken out at these levels. What's nice about these data sets is they start from the official statistics, and then their data scientists apply geographic methods and project these numbers out to these grids. Once we have this, we can look beyond country borders, we can look beyond provinces, and even look beyond cities into sub-city areas. And this gives us a lot of freedom. So once we're into these data sets, we get to start asking some really interesting questions. We start with looking at 1 kilometer squares of maps, which is really disaggregated. What's happening in your 1 kilometer square is important, but you also care about all of those kilometer squares around you. These things construct your neighborhood. And so it's interesting to know if your neighborhood is growing. For that reason, we smooth some of these data. We add up all of the population changes in those square kilometers around you, discounting somewhat for distance. And this gives us a localized population density. And we can begin to look at what the experience of people are in our regions. One thing that we find is that cities, when we define them in this way, cities are generally growing. It's the largest cities, cities of 500,000 residents and over, that are experiencing the largest growth in our regions. When we look at the EBRD regions as a whole, which have experienced this high degree of urbanization, there are lots of places where these people are moving from that you can think of as perhaps being left behind. When we go to this GEcon data that links local populations with local GDPs, we find that those places that are densest in terms of population are also places that have the highest GDP per capita, which is some measure of productivity. So our really densely populated places look like they're also the most productive. We find evidence that suggests that places that are getting denser faster are also those that are getting more productive faster. And we're going to draw in even more granular data. This is nightlight satellite data. What we find is that those cities that appear to be most dense are also those that appear to be most productive.
Now, you're not just reporting statistics here as well, are you? You've used a model to capture the trade-offs that you get from concentrating population and economic activity in cities, some good, some bad. I see it projects positive outcomes for countries like Albania and Mongolia, reaching forward to, I think it's 2040, isn't it? How does this model work? Where do these effects come from?
Right. So despite the analysis that I have just talked about as being very interesting and relevant, it tells us a lot about density and productivity, but that's only part of the story. It doesn't tell us a lot about where things are going to likely be moving into the future. And it also doesn't tell us the trade-off of well-being in these places. Yes, they're more productive, but you're also perhaps crammed in more closely together, and we know that there are some negative impacts that come with that. So this model is going to allow us to look at the data and disentangle some of this. You mentioned Albania. It's a very interesting story. With official statistics, Albania is losing population. There are fewer Albanians living in Albania. On the other hand, the localized population density has been increasing as people are moving out of countrysides into more urban environments. So their population density has increased. And looking at this model, I think that that's where you're seeing this benefit in terms of how well they're doing and projected real GDP growth looking out. To disentangle these things, we went to a model developed by Desmond Noge and Rossi Hansberg called the Geography of Development. This is really interesting. The paper's just been published in this last year. So it was great to get to work with this model and to work with some of the co-authors on that for this report. This is a dynamic spatial model of the economy. It draws these deep forces that we think are driving the patterns that I've described. One is the benefit of density, which is termed agglomeration forces. We have economies of scale. Firms can locate close to their input suppliers and to their potential buyers. In larger cities and denser places, you have large talent pools of labor. Here we can think about Amazon opening offices in Long Island City and Arlington, Virginia. When lots of people are close together, governments are also able to provide investments that impact a large portion of their society. And another key component of this is that with larger markets, firms have this added incentive to innovate, because if they can capture more of the market around them in these larger markets, they're getting significant gains. And so all of this translates into really dense places being locations of greater economic opportunities, and that attracts people to them unsurprisingly, and then these places become denser, and so you have a cycle. That's not the whole story. Places that are really dense come with some really well-known nuisances, such as pollution, congestion, higher rents. These are termed dispersion forces, and these detract from people's well-being. They push people outwards, and what this model is going to do is it's going to weigh these forces at quite micro levels and see where you end up. We begin with population density, and we believe that this spurs innovation. This improves productivity locally. That higher productivity translates into greater consumption opportunities per capita, hopefully at a local level. This greater consumption draws people in. As places become more dense, their underlying amenities, how much you enjoy that place, can be crowded out. These are the balances of the two. What we observe in general from the model in these places is that those with greater population densities today are projected to do relatively well in the future. Here's where you talked about Albania and Mongolia, places that are becoming more dense. They fare relatively better. In general, this benefit that you have from greater consumption seems to be outweighing the negative forces of the congestion. But of course, that depends on how you manage that increased density.
One of the areas in which the bank has historically concentrated its investment is infrastructure, particularly transport infrastructure. How has that affected this geographic transition that we're talking about today?
So something I haven't talked about yet is the trade costs involved. And we have distance that separates places on a map, and the infrastructure between these places, such as roads or railroads, impacts the cost of moving goods between them. We're going to solve the model quantitatively, incorporating the economic data from that GEcon data set I mentioned. And we're going to estimate the trade costs based on existing road, railroad, and waterway infrastructure on the map. One thing that we've done with this analysis is taken investments that the EBRD has done with partners in the Western Balkans. This has improved roads and railway in these areas and dropped transportation costs. And we posed it to the model. What is the impact of this compared against the benchmark of not putting these investments in, looking out to 2040? These investments in infrastructure benefit the communities along these investments, where these investments are made directly, benefits them quite a bit, in the order of 2 to 2.5% in real GDP. This is quite a significant impact. We find that this impact tends to dissipate with distance as you move further away from where those investments are made.
If you travel in the region, you can't help but notice the effect of Chinese investment in infrastructure as well. And China's Belt and Road Initiative, it's often projected to have a significant economic impact in this region. Have you looked specifically at that?
We have. We look at investments from Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, from roads and railroad investment in the region. Specifically, we look at a set of hypothetical investments, which would be all of these possible investments that have maybe been mentioned. We look across three potential routes. We suppose each route is actually implemented and that these routes have drastically reduced the cost of moving goods over them. So actually, we say these railways are very efficient in moving these goods. We take that, we pose that to the model, we re-estimate the trade costs between all the different points, and we ask what is the impact of these investments. Those places that directly receive the impact receive some real boost, and in particular, the places in between. So not necessarily just China to Western Europe, but actually all of these places where the investments pass through. In particular, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan saw gains in real GDP per capita that we've projected, looking out to 2040, about 4 to 6% over the baseline of not having any of these investments made. China and Russia, on the other hand, are seeing gains of about 3%. EBRD region as a whole sees real GDP gains of a little over 1%. And well-being of about 1.7%. These are quite sizable impacts from a hypothetical, really intensive investment in transport.
Last week, Nate, we let Sergey be omnipotent policymaker for a day, so it's only fair to give you the chance as well. Is there a set of trade or investment policies that you have found that would maximize the benefit of this geographic transition in the EBRD regions?
I'd say there are a few key policy areas that we could think about. One is, as we mentioned, these forces driving these changes are very deep and appears to be some real engines for growth, this growth in density. What can detract from that are the negative influences we discussed: pollution, congestion, high prices of rent, of living in these areas. So urban infrastructure that can aim at mitigating these dispersion forces would be very helpful. Here we can think about ways of limiting the amount of pollution being emitted in urban areas. This might be improvements to public transportation or better implementation of taxi fleets or other ways of moving people around and locating them. This can be an improved amount of floor space for people to live, to ease the cost of living in these locations. The other thing I'd say is helping to improve mobility between locations, because we see one way of gaining these benefits is to move from a place that has low productivities to places that have higher productivities, and that might be a very strong way of boosting a person's experience. On the other hand, we know that there are lots of places where this force is happening the other way. There are places that are becoming more sparsely populated, and in that case, this density-productivity correlation is working against them. So in these places, it's either policies to soften that blow or to boost the amenities, provisions of energy, water, educational opportunities. Another thing is just reducing the frictions of trading between places. So one counterfactual we pose to the model is, instead of a very focused investment along, say, a certain railroad route, what if we just do a very, very modest reduction of existing trade costs as they are today? And we find that in a region where the frictions between two places, all the two places in the region are reduced by very small numbers, delivers something similar in terms of real GDP impact and well-being to these very focused. So that can be another measure where we look at creating greater unity between places.
Nate Young, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, the report's available to download or view on the EBRD website. That's ebrd.com. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. If you missed last week's Vox Talk, that's featuring EBRD Chief Economist and CEPR Fellow Sergei Guriev, you can find it by subscribing to Vox Talks on your favorite podcast platform. I really recommend you do that. Or you can listen to the Vox Talks archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.